Abans que res, el doctor Heil no farà la conferència en alemany, que seria el que li suposo li seria més pràctic. Tampoc la farà en català, de manera que ha decidit que la farà en anglès. Tenen dues alternatives, o l'escolten directament o si no encara veiem que hi ha força aparells de traducció simultània, ho dic perquè com que no ho posa potser algú no ho ha vist. Tothom té l'aparellat, tothom que vulgui té l'aparellat. Bé, doncs en aquest cas us agraïm la vostra assistència al que és el 102 ja dels diàlegs d'història urbana i patrimoni, lligats no només a les qüestions rellevants d'interès per un ampli espectre de ciutadans de totes procedències, passions i coneixements, sinó també molt lligat als treballs de recerca en el camp de la historiografia i en el camp del patrimoni del MUBA, el Museu d'Història de Barcelona, que com bé sabeu, ocupant-se com s'ha d'ocupar d'una ciutat bimil·lenària, bé ha de prestar atenció a una qüestió clau com és la del lloc que ja ha tingut en aquesta història de la ciutat i capital, que és Barcelona, els jueus entre l'antiguitat i l'època medieval. Amb dos noms aquí, com poden veure, arqueologia, història i jueus, en relació amb les disciplines esmentades. Per això hem d'agrair molt al professor Johannes Heil, de la Hochschule für Jüdische Studien de Heidelberg, que sigui aquí, però també hem d'agrair al doctor Alexander Fidora el seu interès en dir ep, que valdria la pena que ho féssim i ho programéssim aviat. Doncs bé, així ho hem pogut fer i passo ja la paraula al doctor Fidora de l'ICREA i de la Universitat Autònoma, que és qui presentarà el doctor Heil. Moltes gràcies, Alexander, moltes gràcies, Johannes, i comencem.
Moltes gràcies, és un plaer de veure tanta gent en aquesta sala per aquesta ocasió, aquesta conferència que hem organitzat el meu col·lega Matthias Tischler i jo conjuntament amb el Museu de la Història de Barcelona i de la qual el protagonista aquest vespre és el professor Johannes Heil. El professor Johannes Heil va estudiar un munt de disciplines: història, teologia, filosofia, estudis jueus, però bàsicament crec que es pot dir història perquè és historiador, no? Ha mostrat les capacitats com a historiador en moltíssimes publicacions, articles en revistes especialitzades, llibres, amb un focus temàtic sobretot, però no només, en la transició de la cultura jueva europea de l'antiguitat a l'edat mitjana. Diguem-ne que aquest és un dels seus grans camps d'especialització, que també té a veure amb la xerrada que ens ofereix aquest vespre. A més de les obligacions i els plaers d'investigador, també en té alguns deures i obligacions. Així, actualment és el rector de la Universitat d'Estudis Judaics a Heidelberg, on també és professor, comparteix doncs la tasca administrativa amb la tasca docent i investigadora. I dir-vos també que el seu món doncs és molt ampli, perquè no només s'ocupa dels jueus i de la seva història a l'edat mitjana, sinó que el seu darrer llibre que porto aquí, que es diu Beschneidung, das Zeichen des Bundes in der Kritik, tracta de les implicacions jurídiques, de les implicacions legals de la circumcisió, que ha estat molt debatuda a Alemanya darrerament per uns esdeveniments de nens que es desangraven camí a l'hospital perquè els pares els havien practicat circumcisions, doncs té un ventall d'interessos que va des de l'antiguitat fins a l'època moderna i allò de més contemporani, i per tant doncs és un plaer especial que aquí ens doni la seva visió de l'arqueologia, de la història dels jueus d'Europa, en la qual parlarà, si no m'equivoco, del escenari més ampli, però al final també de la situació més particular a la península Ibèrica. I amb això doncs acabo el meu preàmbul. Herzlich willkommen in Barcelona, benvingut a Barcelona, and now we switch to English and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Juan. Thank you, Alexander. And I'm very sorry that I can't speak in this wonderful language, Catalan, in this wonderful house, in this exceptional museum, and with this great audience. Thank you so much for coming, and I'm glad that you are interested in tonight's topic. And I want to start with a picture which shows you simply the Mediterranean, but I have still to apply for the full screen presentation here. Wonderful. Thank you also for technical assistance. And a short comment to our translator, in case that you have problems to follow me, please interrupt me, that the transmission into your language will be accurate, that I will be not too fast. There can sincerely be no doubt that the Jewish Mediterranean diaspora in Roman times expanded until the west of the Roman Empire and covered also the Iberian Peninsula, so it may have been by far less significant than in Alexandria and elsewhere in Egypt prior to the great uprising of 115 to 117, or in Italy and in Asia Minor during the late Roman Empire. Even that no remnants of monumental synagogues, like in the East, in the Holy Land, or in Ostia near Rome, are known for the Iberian Peninsula from the late classical period, and no pious visitor from the Iberia is mentioned in the list of pilgrims to Jerusalem for Pentecost in the Apostles' Acts, chapter 2, Paul, Shaul, in chapter 15 of his letter to his Roman followers, told twice about his plan to travel to Spain, quanto partiere para España iré a vosotros, and he had sincerely not the intent to travel so far for meetings with Roman pagans, but with Jews and their sympathizers living at the western edge of the Roman Empire. And the text known as the Protocol of a Council at a town named Elvira, and there are two possibilities to locate this town, from about 306, only a couple of years before the Constantinian shift, and regardless if the council has taken place in Elvira or elsewhere, they show the intention to introduce distinctions between Jews of traditional belief and Christians, or for the time, meaning Jewish dissenters. Regardless of the fact that sources remain sparse for the Iberian Peninsula until the High Middle Ages, therefore can be considered the Iberia to be one of the areas in the former Roman Empire where we can assume a continuity of Jewish presence from the antiquity into the Middle Ages. This is what distinguished Spain, together with Italy and Byzantium, from the north of Europe to where not only Christianity expanded only during the early Middle Ages, but also Judaism in a time-delayed process, probably from the 9th, 10th centuries onwards. Most scholars, so not all, would subscribe to this argument. I will return to this question later during my lecture. Yet, a lecture on archaeology, history, and the Jews of Europe between antiquity and Middle Ages requires more than only a simple description of migratory patterns and expansion of Jewish cultures from the south to the north. It also needs to deal with Judaism itself, its changing cultural appearance, and its social setting in politically, socially, and culturally changing environments within the Roman Empire. This is what the two parts of my lecture tonight will deal with. The first part, so to say, the empirical part, will address the issue of findings and their meaning, continuities, and what archaeology can contribute to it, but also the limits of archaeological evidence, an issue which is of special importance for the question about the development of Ashkenaz, which I understand as the medieval Jewish culture of the Latin North of Europe. The second part will take a more analytic approach. When thinking of Judaism, we have a clear concept about texts, about beliefs, about customs, but also about Hebrew as scripture and the Hebrew language and other Jewish languages written in Hebrew, which is true for many Jews nowadays, and also true for the majority of Jews throughout the Middle Ages and the early modern period. Yet, I will emphasize that for the centuries of transition between antiquity and the Middle Ages, the picture is by far not clear, but shows a broad variety of appearances. Several findings during past decades have led to the conclusion of a Jewish presence in Roman times in what were then the Roman provinces of Gallia, but also Raetia and Germania in the north. Such findings are oil candles with the menorah from Trier, now in the museum in Cologne, and found also in other Roman towns. I have only one example here, or a finger ring with the same Jewish symbol from Kaiser Augst, which was a Roman city close to Basel in Switzerland. Mention should also be made of a strange small amulet from a tomb of a young woman in a burial field near Halbturn in Lower Austria, not far from Vienna, found in 2007, a field which has several hundred burials undated so far, but seemingly belonging to the time between the 4th and the 8th centuries. The tiny golden piece shows engraved Greek letters which make no sense if read as a Greek text. However, when reading the Greek letters as a Hebrew text, we find that the piece has the initium of Shema Israel Adonai and so on, which is the centerpiece of the Jewish services and any other religious confession in Judaism. When published, Austrian media immediately communicated the sensational finding of the first Austrian Jew, and related to gender issues, they told that the first Austrian Jew was a woman. The problem, however, is that the burial place in question was sincerely not a Jewish cemetery, since part of the tombs, the majority, were cremation burials, which clearly contradicts biblical and Hilaric practice and also any known Jewish, other known Jewish practice. We can't exclude the possibility that someone who knew about the sacred character of the text and nevertheless, even not knowing about Shema and Judaism at all, attributed no further determined, vaguely magic value to it and offered it to the dead woman. The possibility of such incidents applies also to other findings, and he turns these findings, as I have mentioned, the lamp and the ring, such witnesses into bad witnesses for a Jewish presence, or better, of Roman Jews north of the Alps in the classical period. Or to put it that way, here it comes to the point where thieves and messies are writing history and bringing to us conclusions which do not relate to a historical reality. Different is the discussion about Cologne, Ratisbon, Regensburg, and also Rouen in the Normandy, where arguments for a Jewish presence during the Roman era and from there an ongoing presence into the Middle Ages is based on results from excavations of buildings and observations about the situation of Jewish quarters in the urban topography of medieval cities. Norman Gold has argued for Rouen that the prominent situation of the medieval Jewish quarter, and I have shown you this here in the map with this arrow, that this prominent situation of the Jewish quarter and the existence of a monumental Romanesque building, the Monument Juif, with a few Hebrew inscriptions, which one of them I can show you on the display, leads to the conclusion that Jews were in possession of these areas inside the city from the Roman period onwards, because the deteriorated political and religious situation of Jews in the Middle Ages would not have allowed them to acquire such positions during the High and later Middle Ages. Excuse me. This argument even meets with discourses in the later Middle Ages in German cities, which aimed at justifying pogroms and expulsions of Jews from German cities. Nuremberg is an telling example here, since after the Black Death in 1349 and around 1500, Nuremberg Chronicles report the argument that the Jews once had acquired their houses in the city center by fraud and treason, so that driving them out from there seemed to be more than justified. Similar arguments about the scandalous Jewish possessions in the city centers were made in the 15th and 14th and 15th century in cities like Frankfurt, Rothenburg of the Tauber, Bamberg, Würzburg, Regensburg, Ratisbon, and elsewhere, and also in Cologne. At Cologne, the city hall was in view of the Jewish quarter, or at Frankfurt, the synagogue was just opposite to the main church, to St. Bartholomew's church, which is called the cathedral, but has no bishop, but was the election church of the kings. However, with the exception of Cologne and Regensburg, none of these cities, Nuremberg, Regensburg, Rothenburg, has its origins in the Roman period and give proof to the fact that the centrality, and only give proof to the fact that the centrality of Jewish centers in urban topography underlines the importance of Jews for the formation of the medieval city, but sincerely not as a proof for Roman origins of a Jewish community only because of its situation in the city center. A case which, however, needs a more detailed examination is Cologne, since here we have a whole set of traditions, observations, and interpretations which seem to support the narrative of Roman origins of the Jewish community and an uninterrupted Jewish presence in that metropole from antiquity to medieval times. First of all, there is a decree by Emperor Constantine dating from 321 by which the Jews are commanded to participate in the public offices. The text of this imperial law, effective across the whole empire, is known from its quotation in the Codex Theodosianus and selective and systematic inventory of older imperial legislation compiled more than 100 years later. And for the decree in question, it transmits the version which once had been transmitted to the officials of the Colonia Agrippiniensis. You see in the third line, in the yellow part, Cedimus Judeus ad curiam vocari. So this is what Constantine orders. You should call the Jews to the city council. And this we have in the version which was transmitted to Cologne. A further argument for the preeminence by age of the Cologne Jewish community among the other early Ashkenazi settlements comes from the excavation in the area around the city hall, south of the cathedral, in the center of the Roman city close to the former praetorium, undertaken after the war and again during recent years. These works brought to light, not surprisingly, under the bottom of the medieval synagogue, the one which was destroyed during the Black Death pogroms in 1348-9 and again after the expulsion of the Jews in 1424, an older Roman, much larger construction. You see the apsis of this Roman construction in the model and the much smaller medieval part, which you have also in these two photos. And an apsis which archaeologists interpreted because of its situation to the east as a synagogue from the Roman period. And therefore they inferred from the topographical continuity to an unbroken institutional continuity of the synagogue and its community from the Roman period into the Middle Ages. However, aside formal arguments about the appearance of that Roman building, which remain rather vague, no further evidence for the purpose or use of the building as a synagogue could be revealed. There are no inscriptions or distinct symbols or oil lamps or finger rings or anything else with the menorah, which would clearly indicate that the Roman building in question was a synagogue. To my opinion, even the validity of Constantine's edict of 321 as an argument in the discussion about the age of Cologne's Jewish community can be doubted, since the preservation of an imperial law, which was valuable across the whole empire, in the Codex Theodosianus 100 years later, in its version for Cologne city officials, does not necessarily prove that Jews, be it a few or more, were indeed living at Cologne, because all the Roman cities received that imperial law. To be sure, the Jewish medieval sources of Ashkenaz of the Rhineland didn't know anything about Jews at Cologne before the First Crusade 1096. And the Jews of Speyer, in a brief historical piece telling the story of the foundation of their community in Spira, in Speyer, Spirensis, they called in 1084, briefly before the First Crusade, Mainz, their mother and the most ancient among the communities along the Rhine. And they didn't mention Cologne and Jews there. And it seems hard to imagine, to put the argument still a little bit forward, why, when the Roman administration step by step withdrew from the lands along the River Rhine back into Gaul, the Jewish Romans alone should have found reasons to keep die Wacht am Rhein, the guard at the Rhine, and to stay at Roman citizens alone at Cologne, which was a field of ruins at the time. The most smart historians have argued that the Jews there, from now on, when the Romans had went back, operated as businessmen throughout the Germanic lands, as did the Frisonians, who later established their own quarter at Cologne. This assumption, however, is clearly mistaken by the fact that throughout the late classical period, the Jews in the Mediterranean diaspora were rather landowners and artisans than merchants. This is true for Italy and North Africa, but it corresponds also with sources from the southern parts of Gaul. To mention only a few examples for that, Around the middle of the 9th century, Archbishop Amolo of Lyon blamed the Jews of seducing the simple people in the rural areas so that they would keep Shabbat instead of attending Mass on Sunday. Let aside the question how much he exaggerated, he in any case anyway presented the Jews as members of the rural society. This corresponds with charters about land transactions with Jews involved, mostly with monasteries in southern parts of France up to the 11th century, as Bernard Blumenkranz has shown in his seminal work on Juifs chrétiens dans le monde occidental more than 50 years ago. Concluding this first part of my lecture, I would not go so far to say that historical evidence for Jews always requires Jewish contemporary text, yet the scattered picture which one can gain and the far-reaching conclusions built on it also prove how easily archaeologists and historians alike can come to misconclusions, especially if their work is driven by somewhat romantic desires and even a silent political agenda in the subtext, which aims at showing that Jews were not immigrants but belonging from the very beginning to the ethno-religious setting throughout the Germanic lands, because until at least yesterday, the majority in Germany believed that Germany is no land of immigration and everyone who belongs to Germany had to be there from the very beginning. This is what I hear in these arguments about the continuity of Jews in Cologne from the classical period until today, especially when you hear mayors of major cities speaking about the importance of Jewish history in their town. What concerns the past, we can conclude that at the turn to the High Middle Ages, the Jewish world of the West was still a Roman world of the late antiquity, confined to its historical borders. This includes Italy, the southern parts of Gaul, the Septimania with Barcelona, and the Iberia as a whole, but not the temporary Roman provinces and borders along the River Rhine. This means also that in difference to the Roman Church, which expanded its influence to the north and up to Ireland and England first, the Jewish diaspora remained for long inside the areas of the former Roman Empire and only during the 10th century at the earliest started to establish permanent settlements in the north of Europe. And to be more precise, and following once more Blumenkranz's above-mentioned evaluation of early and high medieval Jewish settlements, one can assume that Jews holding the status of Roman citizens, even at the turn to the Middle Ages in France and elsewhere, were living only south of Lyon and Orléans, with centers in the port in the southern port cities, sincerely in the capital of Septimania at Narbonne, which became, aside the cities in southern Italy, the most important Jewish center at the time, and probably also at Marsella, Arles, Nîmes, and other cities in the south. And this is where also Barcelona comes in. Even that material or written documents related to Jews are largely lacking for Barcelona and the Marca Hispanica up to the High Middle Ages, there can be almost no doubt that from the early 9th century onwards, Septimanian Jewish culture could expand as far as to Barcelona. So we have no early medieval Jewish inscription from Barcelona, as I will show later from other towns on the Iberia. There are two stories related to Barcelona which confirm a considerable Jewish presence here, at least in the 9th century. And you may know these stories, but I just want to repeat it and show you how I put it into my argument. The first one is the report of the Annales Bertignani, written far away and in part probably at Troyes in the Champagne, that the Jews betrayed the town of Barcelona in 848 to the Muslims. This story even seems plausible if we follow the simple pattern of a comfortable Jewish convivencia under Muslim dominion and a veil of tears under Christian dominion, and an argument which made a remarkable career in medieval and early modern and modern accounts about Jewish conspiracy, not only there but also there. Yet, if the Jews of Barcelona would have been indeed so decisive in their orientation toward the Muslims in 848, the further prosperous development of the community at Barcelona during the High Middle Ages would be hardly possible and explicable. And also I should mention that Jews fled before the Muslims with others to the north, as gives proof the Jewish assistant to Bishop Theodulf of Orléans when correcting the Bible, the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, by order of Charlemagne. He had a Jewish translator who probably came from the Iberia, if not from Barcelona. And we have a letter by the Gaon of Sura, Avraham ben Zesna, to the elders of Barcelona, probably dated in the 9th century, but with the datation of the biographies of the Gaonim of Sura and Pumbedita, this is always a little bit problematic, but let's say a letter from the 9th or the 10th century, which is addressed to the elders, the learned men, and their disciples in Barcelona. The other story to mention, almost a miracle story, is the story of the transmission of the Babylonian Talmud to the Jews of Barcelona by a scholar from the East, as given by Judah ben Barzillai, or al-Bargaloni, in the 11th century, which shows that in the memory of later generations, Barcelona played an important role as a harbor for wisdom, for, let's say, rabbinical Judaism, for the reform of classical Judaism, for new Judaism, as a harbor for this wisdom from the East. To be sure, some Jews dwelt also long before the cornerstones of Ashkenaz were laid in the north, in these lands, like Isaac, the Jew who is mentioned in the imperial annals for the time around the year 800, and whom Charlemagne had sent as a translator with his delegation to the Caliph of Baghdad in 798, and who finally brought the only survivor of this four-year-long trip to the Far East, who brought to the Frankish then emperor the gift of the Caliph, among them the elephant, an elephant named Abul Abbas, who lived at the palace of Aachen of Aix-la-Chapelle, still for another 12 years, and Charlemagne is even said to have taken this elephant to his war against the Saxons. So there is a Jew in the service of the Frankish king and emperor in the time around 800. For 906, the Raffelstetten customs regulations at the Danube River between Passau and Linz in today's Upper Austria mention aside Bavarian and slave merchants dealing with wax, corn, salt, and slaves. They mention also Jews. Here, however, we grasp not a traditional network of international merchants, but recent developments in consequence of the political changes of the time, especially with the rise of a new powerful actor centered far away in the north, the Frankish kingdom and empire of the Carolingian dynasty, which provided to Jews new economic chances, but also restricted these non-Christians to distinct activities in trade and communication. Or to put it briefly, Charlemagne was not in need of Jewish farmers. What he needed were people who were able to transgress, to go over borders into the Muslim lands and to bring all the things which they needed for their imperial rituals, and be it the silk, be it the incense, be it precious stones for sacred books and so on, all these things which had to be brought from the markets far away. For antiquity, for late antiquity and the early medieval period, we can say, whereas Christianity expanded, Judaism was still occupied with itself. This does, however, not mean that Judaism remained in agony and misery. In contrast to what the church fathers and early medieval Christian authors taught about the Jews in the aftermath of the cross and the loss of the temple, Judaism then generated with the Mishnah, with the Talmudim, and the whole corpus of rabbinical texts, the Midrashim and others, its own new ideas and concepts of self-understanding and therefore completely new religious articulations, which finally also led to the development of a new and remarkably distinct Jewish culture, or even, let's say, of distinct Jewish cultures in the plural. This is the moment of the deportation of the menorah from the Temple of Jerusalem and the triumphal transmission to Rome, as shown in Titus Ark in Rome, which corresponds with the teaching of the Church of the misery and the agony of Judaism, which would be unable to produce anything of its own in the future because they simply had left the path of sacred history and were historically inexistent. This is the majority picture, but what I want to focus on is how things indeed developed from within. I shall emphasize that all this happened in the aftermath and despite the plagues Jews throughout the Mediterranean had suffered during this period. The war about Jerusalem with the destruction of the temple during the years 67 to 70 at the end with Masada, the diaspora uprising even worse in its effect in the years 115-117, which destroyed almost the whole north of south of the Jewish diaspora in the north of Africa and on Crete and on Cyprus. And finally, the Bar Kokhba revolt under Hadrian in the year 135. Jews and non-Jews had found different answers to these catastrophes. The church built on this the teaching of the punishment and dispersion of the Jews in retaliation of their ignorance toward the cross, toward the Messiah. And at the other side, the mentors of the rabbinical movement, which emerged from the ruins of the Temple of Jerusalem, they developed the teaching of a new examination for Israel by God. What with regard to the past was not so far from the teaching of the church, but completely different for its consequences for Jewish, future Jewish life in the diaspora. Anyway, Judaism in the land of Israel and in the diaspora as well, and even the land of Israel was now diaspora, had not perished and even flourished despite the overall changes which the Roman Empire underwent during the late antiquity, especially following the Constantinian shift and the Christianization of the empire. Judaism maintained the status of a permitted cult, and Jews remained Roman citizens by law. And almost all the monumental synagogues we know were built or expanded during the centuries following the Constantinian shift. I show you examples here from Bar'am in the Galilee, close to the Lebanese border today. I'll show you the famous example from Kvarnachum or Kafarnaum at the Lake of Tiberias, where you can find tourist guides, Israelis and others, telling the people that this is the synagogue which Jesus attended, but it's clear that this synagogue has been built after an earthquake in the 5th century on a smaller synagogue, which probably Jesus and his disciples may have attended, but the one from the 5th century is much bigger in its dimensions. And I show you, even with pagan ornaments, the zodiac for the monthly circle on the floor of the synagogue of Hamat Tiberias, close to Tiberias, and an inscription in that synagogue, which, when you look on the bottom line, has after the whole text is in Greek and the Amen is in Greek, has simply one only word in Hebrew, and you can read Shalom, but all the others are, the whole text is in Greek. And I show you the examples from the diaspora. This is the mosaic floor from the synagogue of Hamadlif in Tunisia, which has a Latin inscription starting with Sancta Synagoga. And then, if at the first glance, it looks like an inscription in a church because of the Latin, but it's clearly a Jewish inscription having at the end, after Tesalavit, it has the menorah as a clear Jewish symbol. And you have a picture of the whole floor with these nice decorations from that North African, I have to say, the only such monumental example I know from North Africa, but there may be others under the sand of these lands. This is the only known example at the moment. I have put another example from a church in North Africa, I put it aside because of the peacocks which appear in all these decorations. These late Roman mosaics in synagogues and churches look very much the same, and only by the text you can distinguish if it is a church or if it is a synagogue, or even if you go on and you go further and you would follow Daniel Boyarin, he even would tell you, you shouldn't make a difference between a church and a synagogue at a time because they were not so clearly divided as we imagine that today. As Judaism was obviously able to respond to the challenges of the time, one should raise the question about its cultural and social profile of this Judaism at a turn to the Middle Ages, especially since the classical Greek and Latin flavor of what we find in the late antiquity stands in sharp contrast to the appearance of the predominantly Hebrew-Jewish cultures during the Middle Ages throughout Europe. As the Greek inscription from Hamatiberias, with only an emblematic use of Hebrew, shows, even in the land of Israel, the Greek-Jewish culture remained a significant factor during these centuries, at least until the 6th century. The synagogue of En Gedi at the Dead Sea has more Hebrew inscriptions, the majority is in Hebrew there. Others, like at Gaza, they are exclusively in Greek, still in the 5th century. Even more complex is the feature when looking on the other parts of the Mediterranean diaspora. I show you Sardis near Izmir in Turkey, Stobi in Macedonia, or one of the most impressive examples, the monumental synagogue of Ostia Antica close to Rome, which has this wonderful menorah in the architrave. And only by this menorah you can know that this building was a synagogue, otherwise you would believe this is a temple of Augustus or any other Roman temple. No, it has been a synagogue. Cesare Colafemina, David Noy, and others have in recent decades inventoried the scattered sources, mostly funeral inscriptions, related to Jewish history of late antiquity, and have augmented this list by new findings. And there are all the time, from year to year, new small things or inscriptions found which can be added to this scattered picture. On the basis of this epigraphic record, Friedrich Lotter, emeritus from Göttingen, has outlined that almost 90% of these sources are not in Hebrew, the majority in Greek, to a smaller part, they are in Latin, and they are the more in Latin, the more they are in the west of the Mediterranean. Which conclusions, however, do these sources permit beyond statistics for the assessment of the cultural profile of Judaism in the time roughly from the 4th to the 8th century? Let us once more have a look on the strange amulet with Greek characters from Halbturn. A piece displaced at the edge or even outside the realm of classical Jewish cultures. Written in Greek by those and for those who knew about the sacred meaning of the invocation Shema Israel, but unable to read Hebrew, or by those who tried to teach the ignorant Greek Jews the sacred language, the Hebrew, or simply by people and for people following rather esoteric impulses and who had only vaguely an idea about the meaning of Shema Yisrael. In the latter case, the amulet would even give a hint to the attractiveness of Judaism within the dynamic religious landscape of late antiquity. Anyway, the amulet gives proof for the hybridity of Jewish cultural articulations, which stands in clear contrast to the linguistically and textually determined medieval Jewish cultures. The amulet from Halbturn is probably an extreme case, with Shema in Greek letters, but it is not an extraordinary case. For the late classical Jewish culture, an object with trilingual Greek, Latin, and Hebrew inscriptions comes from Tarragona, not far from here, and this is a marble piece which has 56 to 45 centimeters, 15 centimeters in height, created at some point between the 5th and the 7th century, and is said to have been a ritual basin, or a child's ossuary, or a mini sarcophagus. Indeed, no clear function can be determined so far for that object today in a museum in Toledo, as far as I know. A menorah, a tree of life, and two peacocks can be seen on the front piece. It bears inscriptions in three languages, and I have shown you the sites aside the main photo. Peace be on Israel, on us and on our children. Amen. Shalom al Israel, aleinu ve'al baneinu. Amen. This is more or less what we know from today's Jewish prayer books, but not exactly the text. It's slightly different with the position of baneinu. Again, we shall ask, by whom and for whom was this peace confected? Serving a Jewish community which was culturally so fragmented that no language could be read and understood by all members of the community, or serving the needs of a highly integrated community which wanted to share the memory and its bracha, its blessings, with the non-Jewish public of the town? I delay the question for the moment. The multilingual version of inscriptions for burials seems to have been a common feature in the Hispania especially, but can be found also elsewhere. I mentioned an Assur stone commemorating a Rav Lazius or Rav Latoyes in the Greek version, again a bilingual, trilingual version, again from Tarragona, which gives a shorter Latin and a longer Greek text, which adds that Latoyes had come from Cyzicus, which is in Asia Minor, today's Turkey, and that he was buried by the Archisynagogus, so the head of the synagogue, presumably his son, whose name, however, is interestingly not mentioned. Another stone from Tortosa with a five-pointed star, or with two five-pointed stars, as they are known also from the decorations of the Kfar Nachum Synagogue and others in the Holy Land. And a menorah is again trilingual with slight differences between the versions. So the Hebrew starts with Shalom al Israel, but the Latin has in nomine domini. The Hebrew reads the name Meliosa, or Meliasa, with Meliosa in the Latin and lacking in the Greek. She is the daughter of, in the Hebrew, Yehuda, Judanti in the Latin, Judaios in the Greek, and Lekira, Kyria, Miriam, Maries, Miriam, for the name of the mother of that young woman. Slight misspellings in all the three versions of that inscriptions indicate that the writer was not fully at home in none of the languages he used in that inscription. Further stone comes from Palarezos, today also in Tarragona, It is in Latin only and bears the menorah as an identificatory symbol. Together with the text, she rests in peace with all Israel. And the stone remembers Isidora, the daughter of Jonatus, or in the biblical expression, Jonathan, and Achaius, the mother. Rabello rightly mentions that the father's name is so far biblical in an accommodated Latin version, Jonatus, so Jonathan. The mother's name is Greek, and the daughter's name is in Latin, what makes, so to say, a transcultural late classical family, Jewish family. I can't present all the pre- and early medieval inscriptions here from the Roman and the Visigothic time, and I leave out three Greek brief and fragmentary inscriptions from Alke, Alicante, and a few others, but I shall mention a piece which came only recently to light when exploring a Roman villa close to Silves in Portugal, and which archaeologists from the Jena University in Germany considered to be the oldest witness of Jewish history throughout the Iberia. Now what you see here, and I'm not sure if someone here in the audience has already seen that piece, what you can see here, it looks like Hebrew. I can understand that people who don't know Hebrew believe this to be Hebrew. It looks like Hebrew. One scholar, I have to say, from Israel, was sure to read Yechiel there. When you are a Hebrew reader, you may follow me that I can't read Yechiel in that text, if I can read anything there. And I have given it to my colleagues in Heidelberg, to the chair of biblical studies and to the chair of the Hebrew Semitic language studies. And my young colleague, Victor Golinets, told me, when read as a Hebrew wording, you may read whatever you want. It is all in there. By the way, I became skeptic from the beginning with this document. It is said it is from the 4th century, and it would be the oldest document for Jewish history on the Iberian Peninsula, because this would be the only example of an exclusively Hebrew text, and then the oldest one, which would contradict the whole rest, all the other results we have from the western part of the Jewish diaspora. So it may be what it is, but when you hear about this wonderful new finding, I suggest to remain skeptic if it is at all a Jewish, a Hebrew inscription. At the other hand, I have to say, also the professor of Semitic languages at the University of Heidelberg, who is at home in, and also the colleague from the Assyrian department, I have shown it around, no one had an idea what language this is. So it remains open to further investigation. So far, the curious item from Tarragona, or one of the tombstones presented here, shall still be considered to be the oldest witnesses for the Jewish history of the Iberia. One may ask why there is no monumental synagogue left in the land of, like in the land of Israel, in Turkey, or even in North Africa, but I'm sure such buildings have existed here. But when looking on how few Christian churches remain from the period prior to 711, it is no surprise that there are, until now, no Jewish synagogues left from that time. When I say there are no synagogues, you may relate to the question of the building at Elche. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, all that town. Elche, thank you. Elche, which is said to be a classical synagogue as far with the inscriptions and the decorations and the form, the basilica form of the building, I'm not pretty sure if this is really a synagogue. It may have been something else, even a church. What we have, like in southern Italy, which was probably then the most important area of Jewish settlement outside Babylonia, then in the 6th and 7th centuries, are a few inscriptions. Considering the cultural and linguistic instability, or let's say openness, of these documents and also the poor artistic state of their fabrication, when you see these inscriptions, which are not pretty well done, one may conclude that we have here, at the bottom of the European Jewish cultures, which are predominating until the present, simply a Jewish culture in decline and in danger to completely disappear. Considering the political environment for Spain, especially the repressive policy toward the Jews after the conversion of the Visigoths to the Catholic faith, one finds further arguments for such an interpretation. Indeed, the majority of what once had been the Mediterranean Jewish culture outside the land of Israel may have merged at some point into the growing church. Nevertheless, these few examples from the Iberian Peninsula, but also the much bigger corpus of South Italian inscriptions, give proof to a highly dynamic Jewish society. Let's put the things together. Long-distance migration, like from Cyzicus in Asia Minor, which we have in the stone from Tarragona, or in South Italian inscriptions, names which clearly show a provenance from North Africa, in Hebrew inscriptions from the 9th century, then culturally mixed families, the archisynagogus and other honorary offices as a precondition for well-established community life, the absence in these inscriptions of the Jewish calendar in the obituaries, which used, if at all, secular forms of dating, common Roman and Greek names like Isidora or Faustinus, which we have in many of the South Italian inscriptions. Apostoli in the South Italian inscriptions, most probably as messengers from the land of Israel. Jews mentioned in inscriptions as holders of communal, of general offices, and so on. All this, in summary, contributes to the picture of a self-conscious Jewish society which was not and did not need to be integrated, but participated in public life and society. And this community had, if we think once more about the curious object from Tarragona, its own forms and traditions, which we today don't know and don't understand today, but which sincerely were not less Jewish than the Jewish objects we know today. Therefore, our sources can be read as witnesses for a Jewish culture which, despite all the losses at the time, aimed at standing all given challenges, also by openness to new impulses from outside. The growing acceptance of Hebrew from emblematic words into texts into a new textual tradition, which can be seen here, but especially in the catacombs of Venosa, which you have here two pictures in this slide. Venosa in the Basilicata in southern Italy, and other places along what I call the Via Appia Judaica, from Naples to Brindisi and Otranto, shows how the text-centered rabbinical reform, which had originated from the small circles in Babylonia and the land of Israel, expanded continuously into the West and provided a new basis and new understandings of Judaism as a distinct culture. And I come to a conclusion. For the reception of the rabbinical reform at the Iberian Peninsula, Barcelona seems to have played a major role, which is mirrored in that account by Judah ben Barzillai, and the reception of the Talmud here. The portable sanctuary of the scriptures had replaced the Temple of Jerusalem. The Hebrew provided a sacred linguistic and textual sphere exactly at a time when the Greek and the Latin had been turned into the holy languages of the Christian cults and practices. The Romans' vernaculars became therefore the linguistic and social meeting places across religious borders with a new linguistic distinction between the secular and sacred spheres at all sites, Christians and Jews and Muslims. Thank you.
Moltes gràcies, Johannes Heil, per a aquesta conferència que d'una banda ens ha presentat un material abundant, tant arqueològic com escrit i a més ben documentat i ben visible, si no palpable per a nosaltres aquí en el PowerPoint, però que per l'altra banda hi ha afegit, em sembla, una reflexió metodològica molt important sobre precisament l'abast d'aquest material o de la interpretació d'aquest material i també els perills i les trampes, podríem dir, metodològiques en l'aproximació a aquest material. Jo no és la meva feina comentar, sinó que la meva feina més aviat aquí és obrir un debat, ja que tenim a Johannes Heil aquí i marxarà demà, és a dir, que la pregunta que no li fem avui ja no li podrem fer, i evidentment doncs, en tots els idiomes que vulgueu, fins i tot en hebreu, si algú sent la necessitat i en té la capacitat. Doncs obrim el debat i podeu preguntar, em sembla el professor Heil està obert a rebre tota mena de preguntes i contestar tota mena de preguntes.
Demanin el micròfon, eh? Tenim a punt. Allà n'hi ha una.
Endavant. Algú ha de ser el primer, no? És dur, però...
Podràs traduir a l'anglès? Segurament
com vulguis,
serà...
Com vulgui.
Dankeschön, Herr Heil. Quan comentava la presència dels jueus, especialment al sud d'Itàlia, podríem fer algun tipus de connexió amb el fet de que Bizanci en aquella època controlava el sud d'Itàlia, ho diré demà, Sicília, una mica potser que estaven més presents en l'imperi oriental romà que en l'occidental i que era una entrada que tenien.
Would we collect the questions or?
No, we just.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for the question. This is completely right because when we ask for the conditions of the development of the Jewish communities, Jewish settlements, the Jewish presence in southern Italy, it is clearly an impact of Byzantine rule. And Byzantine rule went so far as to Minorca and others. So the same what applies to South Italy for the time of Justinian applies for the islands, for Sardinia, for the Balears, and for Spain. Not because the situation for Jews in the Byzantine Empire was so comfortable, and they followed the Eastern Roman emperors and their armies. To the contrary, the restrictive policy, especially by Justinian, oppressing the deuterosis, so meaning the non-Greek new textual traditions like the Mishnah, and promoting only the cult in Greek, with the idea that that way the Jews would understand the truth of the Septuagint in the right way and would at the end become Christians because they would find the understanding for the true faith. This oppressive policy pushed many Jews from the center of the Byzantine Empire to the edges of the empire, and maybe the reason why we have this strong Jewish settlement in southern Italy, which still was inside the empire, but far away from the control of an effective imperial administration, which left more liberty. And the same when we consider the events in the 5th, 6th century at Menorca and other things may apply for the situation in the Balears and in the Iberian Peninsula. Yes, this is much related. So this is why I would expect also for the future more findings here as we have in Southern Italy. Imagine it was the effect of earthquakes that these Jewish catacombs from the time up to the 9th century were rediscovered from the 17th, 18th century onwards, and still there are parts which Colla Femina and others documented some decades ago which are inaccessible today due to further earthquakes. So we don't know what we will find tomorrow, but sincerely not a stone from Silvers.
Danke schön.
Thank you, Johannes, for your fine talk, paper you gave to us. I may ask in English, because it will be translated. Referring to Barcelona, I would like to know a little bit more about this testimony you mentioned in the Annales Bertignani, to explain its something like the continuation of the official annalistic writing of the Carolingian time in the western part of the empire. It's very interesting because I think we know the author in this part is Prudentius of Troyes. Prudentius of Troyes was, Galindus was a West Gothic pupil coming from Septimania. My question is now, is this testimony on betraying Barcelona to the Muslims, which was a city, important city, our city here, captured by Louis the Pious, Carolingian city, is this testimony something like a testimony of latent or open Visigothic anti-Judaism, or is it Carolingian perspective on the problematic of the Marca Hispanica and, well, a region under influence, still under influence of the Carolingians at that very time in the middle, because we have at the very time a conflict between Cordoba, a scandal of a deacon coming from the empire who converted to Judaism, the Bodo Eleazar scandal, and he engaged the Muslims to conflict with the Christians here in this area. So I would like to know a little bit more about the background, let's say, of this very interesting testimony in the Annales Bertignani.
Thank you, Matthias, and you're right to mention Bodo when speaking about this report about the capture of the town of Barcelona in 848, because Prudentius also tells the conversion of Bodo in 838, so which is 10 years before the said event at Barcelona. Well, there is no constant position of Carolingian politicians and Carolingian writers towards Jews. They can be friendly, they can be less friendly. As I mentioned, Amelot, or you may mention Agobard of Lyon. There are other voices which sound different. And I have mentioned the assistant to Theodulf of Orléans, who is also a Visigoth, most probably earlier in the century, at the beginning of the century, when helping Theodulf to correct the Bible. It seems that Prudentius has a very critical, even hostile stand toward the Jews, and he uses that position for different occasions. Because the support of a minority for the enemy when overtaking the city. This is a running gag in historiography, and nothing special which happened, which must have happened here in Barcelona, only because the Annales Bettignani are telling this story. So I have the impression Prudentius is very nervous about the events and the conversion of a deacon, which was not a simple deacon, but a deacon at the court. He was in a high rank at the court, at the Carolingian court, was considered to be a scandal. Nevertheless, only a few voices made a scandal out from it, which is also interesting. Others didn't mention it at all. And this is a very unclear situation, what exactly the position of Galindus Prudentius in that moment is. I have also the impression that about Bodo, even that he was a high-ranking deacon before he converted to Judaism, the impact of a converted Christian who became a Jew to mobilize the Muslim armies to conquer the Christians, if we think in reasonable terms about that situation, seems rather limited to me. So we have a certain way of probably Visigothic consideration of political situations within the Carolingian Empire, having a look on Iberian developments and then taking conclusions about what's going on there, with probably the subtext, I don't want to switch now from the Carolingians to the Bush administration, but it sounds a little bit this idea, we want to go in there right now. This is what seems to be the attitude of the Annales Bettignani. We have to get involved into the Iberian affairs, and the Jewish scandals, which he reports, are only a small part from that major strategy. So don't tell that I compared the Annales Bettignani to Rumsfeld.
Alguna pregunta més, en general, referida a Barcelona? Bé, doncs, moltes gràcies. Vielen Dank, Dr. Heil. Moltes gràcies a l'Institut d'Estudis Mediterranis, a Alexander, al Matías. Moltes gràcies a vostès i seguirem tant amb el tema com amb d'altres temes de reflexió i debat històric, com ja tenen el programa i no fa falta repetir. Moltes gràcies també per la traducció, que
moltes gràcies.
Bona nit a tothom.
Ich habe die ganze Zeit gedacht, der Übersetzer sitzt da drüben. Dann hätte ich mit ihm ja Augenkontakt.
Així passo per casa.